Hello, and welcome to 21 and 21. I'm Haley Burko, and today I'm speaking with Alex Pruden. Alex is the CEO of Project 11, an applied R&D lab focused on the intersection of quantum computing and cryptography. He's also the chairman of Alio and previously worked at Andreessen Horowitz and Coinbase. Before all that, he served in the Army Special Forces. Alex, welcome to Presidio Bitcoin.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Of course, and thanks for getting here early before all the quantum fun kicks off.
Early bird gets the worm, right?
Yes. Cool. Well, we're just going to try to get through as many questions as we can in 21 minutes. Ready to go?
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So first question. You've been a VC, a builder, and a soldier. What sparked your passion in cryptography?
I discovered Bitcoin as a soldier working in the Middle East. I was introduced to Bitcoin, working with the Syrian rebels originally. And and the idea really stuck with me because it is a form of Bitcoin and, cryptography generally, but Bitcoin specifically enables you to put your wealth in your head, right? If you have a brain wallet, you can just memorize your private key and go across a border and start all over. So that concept, for me, just since I was working among people who were refugees from Syria in that conflict, it was really powerful. And that's what inspired me to get into Bitcoin, which inspired me to get into crypto and then cryptography specifically at Stanford. And that's just how I've come to love all these like deeply cryptographic technologies like zero knowledge and quantum and stuff. So
very cool. So can you maybe tell our listeners a little bit more about Project 11 and then the Q-Day clock?
Yeah, sure. So Project 11, you said it already, it's an applied lab at the intersection of cryptography, quantum computing. And I think maybe I'll just say this, the mission is really future-proofing and future-building. So we're not doomsdayers. I actually think quantum computers are a great thing for humanity. We want it to happen, but we need to prepare for it. And obviously there's a lot of implications to systems like Bitcoin. So we need to future-proof those systems and apply post-quantum cryptography to them. This applies to a lot of things beyond Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is our initial focus. But future building is kind of the second piece where we can leverage quantum mechanics and quantum computing to build new cryptographic primitives that I hope get integrated someday into a future Bitcoin protocol and just future, and define the way we communicate and interact in the future. So, so those are the focus. That's the focus of the company. Like I said, right now, we're mainly focused on future proofing Bitcoin specifically. So we have our initial product called Yellow Pages, which I can talk a little bit more about later, but that's the high level.
How would you even define like a future-proofed, like quantum-resistant Bitcoin? Like, what does that really even like mean?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is a system based on public key cryptography, and the assumptions underneath current techniques for public key cryptography are all broken in a world of a quantum computer. So those schemes all need to get replaced, right? And what that means for Bitcoin is the underlying protocol needs to be able to verify new signatures. And so you need to replace the signature scheme inside the protocol. And then I think this is the thing a lot of people miss, is every single wallet, UTXO holder of Bitcoin has to migrate, right? So you could, the Bitcoin is arguably not secure as long as there's any Bitcoin that is stealable, quote unquote, or gettable by a quantum computer. I mean, people may argue that point, but fundamentally, that's what you need to do. You need to fix the underlying system and then you need to get everyone to migrate to the new one.
Well, maybe elaborating that on a little bit more, kind of, what's one thing that people misunderstand about preparing for the post-quantum world?
So I mentioned that everyone has to migrate, and I think that's often one that people misunderstand. I think the other thing that a lot of people misunderstand is I think there's an assumption that we'll see this coming from a long way away, and there'll be time to prepare. And I don't believe that's a good assumption. And I don't believe it's a good assumption because if you think about the use cases for a quantum computer, the most near-term use case is cryptanalysis, and the most economically profitable way to apply cryptanalysis is by breaking Bitcoin. But if you tell everyone that's what you're doing, obviously you could imagine a world where some chaos is introduced in the markets, maybe price goes down, maybe people sell, you accelerate people adopting some defense. So really, you're not incentivized to tell anybody that you have this capability. I mean, this is even true for governments if they had it and they didn't care about Bitcoin, that they just cared about listening to each other's emails or, reading each other's emails. The point being is like, if you have this tech capability, you're not incentivized to share it. And so we may only find out about it after the fact, which is why I think the attitude of we can wait to see when more developments happen is misguided. And so I think that to me is a misperception.
Got it. What are you thinking about with the intersection of AI and Bitcoin?
honestly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the intersection. I think about cryptography and Bitcoin being an application of cryptography as being a very valuable counterweight to AI. I think because cryptography is fundamentally about empowering individuals, right? And like you, not your keys, not your crypto, or your keys, only your crypto, right? And if you encrypt your messages, I can't read them. This is very like empowering to individuals. AI is a very powerful tool, but I view it as a very centralizing tool. I mean, it really only works because it's sucked up the data of the entire internet up to this point. And as it gets better and better, it kind of relies on being able to know what you're doing. And you know, and it, by the way, like in the hands of a few people, I think it can be a very powerful tool of control. And that's why I think cryptography and Bitcoin is a very important antidote to that in this day and age.
Have you vibe coded anything cool?
I have a blog that I have vibe coded. Yeah. So, and it's fun. I mean, look, I don't want to like doomsday AI. I think AI is a powerful technology, but I think, you know, cryptography is also important. That said, yeah, I've played with all the tools. Vibe coding is kind of fun. Working with a bunch of very, you know, deeply technical engineers who focus on cryptography. If I were them, I would not be worried at all about being replaced by an AI. I think it can do front end things. It can do simple stuff, but I think the deep subject matter expertise and high stakes scenarios, I think it's a long way away from being able to do.
So having kind of this passion in cryptography and this unique path to kind of falling down this rabbit hole, what narrative really spoke most to you that you think we could maybe like encourage others who are maybe not Bitcoiners but have an interest in cryptography to like either work on Bitcoin or kind of really start thinking more about it?
I mean, maybe unique to me is I would say that, I mean, I'm very passionate about the cryptography, and but I didn't start out being very technical. I was a Green Beret. I was a soldier. I didn't have a background at all in anything related to math or cryptography. And I got into it, and I think what I have kind of discovered through this process is it's amazing how much you can learn over time and how much knowledge you can build over time. And approaching something like Bitcoin with a humble attitude and not pretending like you know everything, but just trying to learn something new every day. And by the way, Bitcoin isn't a very complicated and complex thing, right? There are many dimensions to it. That goes double when you start expanding beyond Bitcoin. But I think people can, who want to work on Bitcoin, who maybe are interested in the ideas that it represents, should be inspired by my story potentially, because I started from zero, and now I'm contributing in the way that I've described already, and I think anyone could do what I did. So I don't know.
How did you even start? Were you watching YouTube videos, podcasts, books?
Yeah,
that was one of the less technical background.
I mean, I was kind of just watching YouTube videos, and then I was fortunate to get to go to Stanford for my MBA, but I was moonlighting in the computer science school learning cryptography. And I did what I don't recommend doing this, but I skipped the basic computer science classes. And I just kind of started straight with cryptography. But I threw myself in situations that were uncomfortable and forced myself to learn. And it was hard. It took a while, but you got to start somewhere. I mean, it's like kind of I guess maybe the takeaway is don't worry about where to start. Start somewhere.
Have you read any recent books or listened to any articles or podcasts recently that have really like blew your mind or you want to recommend?
Oh yeah. Well, I just finished Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman. It's a piece of Russian literature in the 20th century. It's excellent. And I guess maybe the intersection between that book and Bitcoin is a big theme of that book is human freedom and kind of the innate desire of people to be free. And I think, you know, this is obviously very consistent with stuff that like Alex Gladstein says from the HRF. I think Bitcoin is freedom money and Bitcoin empowers you like because it's a cryptographic tool. So definitely recommend Life and Fate. It's, as you would expect of Russian literature, it's quite long, but it's very worth a read.
I'll check it out. What do you think a world on the Bitcoin standard would look like in an ideal way for you?
Honestly, I think it would look like individuals are broadly comfortable managing and taking care of or being responsible holders of their own cryptographic key material. I think, you know, and this is one of the perennial challenges with cryptography is this UI problem of, you know, cryptographic objects and keys are hard to easy to lose and it's hard to manage. I think that's what drives a lot of people towards centralized solutions, which kind of defeat the point. I think maybe I'll describe what I don't want to see first. What I don't want to see is like the Bitcoin standard is adopted, but the only way you can send Bitcoin is through some centralized gateway. It's like, what are we even doing at that point? So I hope that the world, as the Bitcoin standard becomes a reality, I hope that we retain this self-sovereignty that was just a critical part of why Satoshi started it all. And I don't think that can be taken for granted at all. I mean, if you look at Bitcoin and the majority of holdings, it is not on individual wallets, and most people don't do these basics. And that's on, there's two levels of that. One is people, I think, need to have more agency and they need to take more ownership that this is important. They need to invest in learning and understanding this and understand the stakes. And two, I think there's a lot of new, cool cryptographic and just technological ways to make that experience easier for people. So I'm hopeful those happen.
Hopeful too. Are there any specific projects in the Bitcoin space that you're excited about right now?
So you mentioned I was, so aside from P11, so that's what I spend most of my time on, is focusing on the quantum stuff. But aside from that, you know, I'm the president of the board for the Aleo Foundation, and Aleo is a zero knowledge cryptography company. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff happening with Bitcoin and ZK these days. So there's, you know, BitVM and Citria. I think mostly focused around using ZK to help Bitcoin scalability. And I think those are both really cool. Yeah. So ZK on Bitcoin is something that I think is interesting.
Maybe in layman's terms, can you tell our listeners what ZK on Bitcoin is?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, first off, what's zero knowledge cryptography? It's basically a cryptographic technique to prove a fact without revealing it's true. And do so in a succinct way. So you can prove a long statement in a short with a short proof. That second piece is really how this is applied on Bitcoin, because, you know, Bitcoin blocks have a lot of transactions, and over time the blockchain gets large, and I think there's a desire for clients to be able to sync faster in a more trustless way without having to rely on a third party. And so you can generate cryptographic proofs saying like, hey, this series of blocks, all the transactions were correct, and you don't have to go through and verify all the signatures individually. So really, for the purposes of ZK on Bitcoin, the takeaway for everyone should be that this helps to compress the chain and make it more accessible to verify.
Thank you for explaining that.
No problem.
What do you think the role of stablecoins should be?
Well, I think it's naive to assume that there will not be fiat currencies going forward. I think, you know, fundamentally, we live in a system of sovereign states, governments. We don't live, you know, that's the world we live in. And I think for a variety of reasons, those sovereign states and governments will issue their own currencies. So I think it's inevitable that stablecoins will exist. As many fiat currencies as exist, stablecoins will exist. And I think for a lot of reasons, that's a good thing. I think if you look at payments, for example, the preponderance of people prefer to conduct business in something that has a stable value, right? And this is kind of a benefit of something like a fiat currency. But obviously there are drawbacks, which we're obviously all living through in an era of inflation and like M2 money supply increasing. And so this is why I think something like Bitcoin is very good, because it's an escape valve from when those systems get abused. So in short, I see these things as, I mean, both of them, stablecoins are issued on blockchains. And blockchain technology is kind of more inherently decentralized than the banking system. So I think that's great. And I think as instances of cryptocurrencies, I think they balance each other out in many ways. I think both are important.
Do you have any spicy Bitcoin takes?
Ooh, spicy Bitcoin takes. I think my spiciest take is that not to take for granted that price of Bitcoin equates to success of Bitcoin. I think, you know, especially these days, there's a lot of companies that are doing treasury strategies and a lot of big economic actors that have come into the space. And I don't think many of those people share the values of Satoshi and the early cypherpunks or the values that I think make this technology unique. And so I think while we can celebrate prices at all-time highs, and that's great, I think we should not lose sight of the fact that there's still a long way to go to actually really get Bitcoin adoption, not just in terms of like as an asset class, but in terms of the values that it represents. And that can't be taken for granted. And I think it sometimes is.
For sure. Speaking about having a long way to go, are there any kind of projects that you would be excited about seeing other people build to help get to a future you want to see?
Yeah, well, there's always a need for better wallets. I think there's a lot of great opportunity to, build in newer forms of online identity into like blockchains like Bitcoin. And so you're kind of solving, going back to something I said earlier, that's a challenge for adoption is UX is always tricky, public key management. And there's a lot of interesting approaches to use, for example, zero knowledge cryptography to be able to prove that you're a real person inside of potentially, you know, a transaction on chain, stuff like that, I think is really cool. So I think products that help improve the UX for people and help onboard them into, again, like being their own self-sovereign agents in this world is something that I'm really excited about.
Definitely. The UX needs to be easy for people to want to use it. It's definitely improving a lot, but there's still a ways to go.
Yeah, like it's improving a lot. And I think everyone always says this and it sounds like a cop out, but you know, like the internet was, the internet was around for 20 years before a browser even existed, right? And so these things take time. I mean, it takes a while to understand how people use them. And obviously, as adoption grows and different use cases happen, there are new kind of UX needs. And so this is not something that happens overnight. It's kind of a perennial thing that has to adapt because people adapt, right? People change, people evolve. And so I think that, you know, that's why I think it's important to always stay on top of it and not just settle. And this is something actually maybe just as a slightly other spicy take is that this is, and by the way, what I'm about to say, Bitcoin is true of every cryptocurrency. The vast majority of intellectual energy goes into protocol improvements, which are very important. But going back to the quantum thing, like there is this aspect where users have to migrate, right? And this is actually Project 11, like the problem that we're tackling. There are people like Hunter and the Enduro folks that focus on BIP360, and I think that's all great. The protocol has to get adjusted. But I think there is this real UX problem that emerges. You have to move assets from one to the other. And I think a lot of energy gets paid, or a lot of attention and energy gets put on the protocol level because it's kind of fun to comment on, and there's like a lot of interesting, cool stuff. But there's a lot of really important low-hanging fruit, frankly, at the UX level that I think people should pay more attention to.
Definitely. It will be interesting to see kind of different ideas that come up to make that kind of easiest as possible.
Definitely.
Well, you are cruising through these questions. I appreciate it. Okay, a few more questions. How do you think companies can best support open source developers and software?
Pay them. That's the easiest answer. Yeah, I think pay them. I think, or alternative to paying them directly, I think they can contribute to nonprofit organizations that basically incentivize the creation of this open source software. You know, and lastly, look, I think blockchains are kind of an incredible mechanism to incentivize the development of open source software. Let me just use zero knowledge cryptography as an example. I mean, zero knowledge cryptography has been around for almost as long as AI, and it was just not practical for 30 years, and many people thought it was never going to be practical. And then there's a cryptocurrency called Zcash, which actually kind of grew out of the Bitcoin community and emphasized privacy, and it used zero knowledge cryptography, and that kind of led to an explosion of different protocols and development around these protocols that accelerated to the point where, like I said, you can use like these things are production ready enough to implement in Bitcoin. Like do real-time proving for identity and all kinds of things. So blockchain technology generally, or like decentralized blockchains, are a great way to incentivize open source. But yeah, look, I think the challenge is always the public goods problem. People want the best thing and they don't want to pay for the best thing. And, you know, that's a good short-term strategy. It's a bad long-term strategy. And, you know, I think that's something I would ask companies to remember.
Totally agree. Someone that works at Spiral, I'm very pro companies paying open source developers. Switching gears, what's something that you learned while you're in the Army Special Forces that shapes how you lead or build today?
Wow. I guess maybe one thing I learned culturally is that, you know, I've been all over the world. I've been to Afghanistan, I've been to Iraq, I've been to Turkey, I've trained a bunch of other places, worked with Syrians. And people aren't that different from each other world over. Right? I mean, it's easy, I think, if you just watch the news and be like, you know, it's like Muslims or Jews and Christians and Americans and French or Russians and South Africans. You know, it's easy to like figure out these, you know, in-group, out-groups in your head. But I think when you get down and you have a conversation like we're having, it's there's far more that unites us than divides us. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think something like crypto and Bitcoin is so universal, because I think it's empowering in a way that all people find valuable. And, you know, I think, frankly, many people outside of the US, even more so than within it, see the value proposition for that self-sovereignty that I was describing earlier. But yeah, that's something that I took away, that I'm very happy for my Army career to have given me, was this appreciation for people, even in like the mountains of Afghanistan, who don't even know what a computer looks like. They kind of want the same things as everybody else, like people down the street from me in Montana. So
it's very interesting. And yes, Bitcoin is very cool that it is such a universal currency and something that can connect us all.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Last question.
Okay.
If you could leave our listeners with a single thought about Bitcoin, what would it be?
Celebrate its successes, but don't underestimate the task ahead. There's no guarantee that the success to date guarantees that this will be something in the future. And the that success will be guaranteed by people's continued contributions. To use an analogy for like the Army, right? Like it's kind of, I think there's a quote, like liberty is maintained through the blood of patriots kind of thing. It's like kind of this way people try and convince you to join the Army. But similarly to open source software and Bitcoin in particular, like the work is never done. It always continues. And I think this is why it's important that for people that feel passionate about it, to not be afraid to contribute and not be afraid to contribute in any way they can to the discussion, to the technical parts, to both, to learn to do one or the other, and not just be a user. Back to the open source software thing. Yeah, companies should pay, I think, open source developers. But look, people also have to want to contribute. They have to pay in the sense of like, this is a community effort. There's not a Bitcoin company, right? We are all the Bitcoin company. And there's the same public goods risk that everyone just phones it in, takes it for granted. And then suddenly we're in that bad world that I described earlier, where like, yeah, Bitcoin exists, but like you can only access through your bank account. And then what are we doing, right? And that has to be fought for. And so that's the thought I would leave everyone with.
It's a great lasting thought. So if our listeners want to learn more about you, follow along with what you're doing, what should they do? Where should they go?
Yeah. So X is kind of where I'm easy to find me. I'm on Nostr, but I haven't like posted as much there. So I'd say X, Aprudin08 is my handle. Project11.com is our website. And there's a blog there. So I've authored some stuff there. And the personal blog that I'm in the process of vibe coding is sadly not live yet. So, but it is going to be called Homo Universalis. I have bought the domain name homouniversalis.xyz. So maybe someday people can go there and there will be something. But anyway, X probably is the best place to start, Aprudin08.
We'll keep a lookout for your Vibe Coded website.
Great.
Thank you so much for hopping on the show. I hope you enjoy the rest of your time at Presidio Bitcoin and the Quantum Bitcoin Summit.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
Of course. Thank you.